Another thing you've also talked about in your book was the account of Jesus and the rich young ruler. What significance does this have on how we should view discipleship?
Well, okay. To do that briefly, let me put it this way. The young ruler asked Jesus how to be saved. What shall I do that I can inherit eternal life? How can I live forever? Jesus then issued the call to discipleship. He issued it in the very same words, basically, that he issued it to many others, like to Peter and Andrew and James and John and Levi and so on. He said some of the very same things to the rich young ruler that he said to them, take up your cross and come follow me. So that what becomes clear to me out of that is that when you want to know what you need to do to be saved, Jesus responds to that by calling you to be a disciple. As he did to the rich young ruler. Consequently, Jesus' answer to being saved is, be my disciple. That's what you need to do in order to be saved. Now, I don't think that contradicts salvation by grace through faith. I think it just helps us understand better what faith really means. Faith includes, then, the kind of commitment to Jesus that a disciple makes when he becomes a disciple. So becoming a Christian and becoming a disciple are just two ways of saying the same thing, as I see it in terms of the way Jesus dealt with the rich young ruler. And it seems to me like there are three particularly important demands that are involved there in becoming a disciple that Jesus challenged the rich young ruler with and that ultimately challenge everybody who answers the call to discipleship. Or, in other words, to be a Christian. One of those is to break your ties with anything that's going to be your master other than God. And that's why he asked the rich young ruler to sell everything, because that was his master. At least that seems clear to me in that regard. Another of those demands is to take up a cross. And that is a call to take up a way of execution. It's a call to death. It's not a piece of jewelry to be worn, as we often do with the cross. It's not even a burden to be borne. It's dying. It's as if Jesus had said in our day to someone, if you want to be my disciple, bring along your electric chair for your execution. That's what a cross was. It was a place of criminal, shameful execution. So that's a part of the demand of being a disciple in that regard. And the third thing is, he said to him, come follow me. That's what a disciple is. The word disciple means a learner, a pupil, a student. And so in those days, a disciple was someone who aligned himself to a certain teacher and then began to learn from that teacher and to emulate those teachings into his life as a follower of that particular teacher or master. So that's what I learned from Jesus' encounter with the rich young ruler that talks about being a disciple, which means then what's required to be a Christian. That's serious business, of course, but that's where I think the rich young ruler account comes in. And the various other what we sometimes call hard sayings of Jesus fit into that very same category, but I won't go into those right at this moment.
What would you say to high school students who are seeking to take up their crosses daily in an environment that is increasingly difficult to acknowledge Jesus as Lord?
That's a tremendous question. And what I would say, first of all, is those three things that I mentioned a moment ago, to face up to each one of those, starting with breaking ties with anything else that would otherwise be the master of your life. God doesn't want people who have two masters. Jesus said, you can't serve God and mammon. He didn't say don't do it. He said you can't. And you can't. So that I think the very first thing is to settle right at the very root of one's heart who your master is going to be. It can't even be yourself. That's why he said you got to deny yourself. It can't be your possessions. That's why the rich young ruler had to sell his. And why he said you've got to hate your very life also. It can't be sin. Sin tries to master all of us. That's the devil's way of ruling our lives. So that the very first thing and the most important thing is to settle within one's own heart who one's master is, I think. And then, having done that, just simply live Christ's way, to follow him, is to put into practice his teachings. In the Great Commission, Jesus said, make disciples in all the nations, teaching them to observe all things whatever I've commanded you. And that's what a disciple does. He puts into practice the teachings of his master, of his Lord, of his teacher. And so I think what anybody has to do applies to what the young person, say today, as you say, in high school has to do. He has to decide, who's going to be my Lord? Am I going to run my life? Am I going to let the crowd run my life? Am I going to let my peers run my life? No, you can't do that and be a disciple of Jesus. You decide to let Jesus run your life and to live according to his teaching. I think that's even more important, at least it's more basic, than what we often hear about being a witness. Certainly being a witness is tremendously important, yes. But if the individual first settles in his own heart and life, who's going to be his master? And then does his very best to live according to the teachings of that master, then it won't be so hard to find opportunity to be the witness that a person should be in that regard. So that's basically what I would say to a young person asking that kind of question of me these days.
And for a high school student like me that will be graduating next year, what advice would you give to students like us who are seeking his direction as disciples in adult life decisions such as marriage, providing for family, career path, and other things like that?
Well, probably a good part of that answer would be the same as what I just gave you to that other question, or at least there would be overlap and I would repeat, so I'll try to avoid the repetition. But once you settle who your master is and then determine to follow his directions for life, that's the key to it. After that, then, I would say one of the important things would be to seek out a really good Christian education, a college where an individual could go to get really sound, biblically directed, biblically grounded teachings about life and right and wrong and all of those other things that go with that. For a person in high school, the next most important decision he's going to make after high school, I think, is going to be college. There are others that are equally important. Career is obviously all that important. And as you say, marriage is obviously that important too. But I think college is the one that comes next, mostly these days. So a good college, a Christian college, a college like Welch College, for example, would be the thing that I would probably start with in advising a young person such as yourself who's thinking about the rest of life. Then, in terms of the other things, it's a matter of doing what we've just been talking about in terms of discipleship, letting the Lord run things so you seek his direction. That's done through prayer. It's done through also making very sure that what you want is the Lord's will rather than just pure selfish will. With settling that and making it a matter of prayer and having a good Christian education and seeking God's guidance then in making career choices and marriage choices and things like that. Obviously, I think every Christian young person should consider the possibilities of ministry, but the trouble with that is that in most people's thinking, the word ministry just means preaching, you know, or something like that. There's lots of forms of ministry. And not everybody should be, even for that matter, in what we think of as ministry. The world needs Christian doctors and lawyers and carpenters and farmers and mechanics and everything else. So that the vocational choice is obviously an important one that a person would give a lot of time and prayer to and consideration. What kind of gifts God's given them, to seek to understand those gifts. Then obviously the matter of marriage is probably the single most important decision other than becoming a Christian that a person ever makes in life. So again, seeking God's guidance in that regard, making sure that it's a person that matches your desire to live for God. Paul talks about being unequally yoked together and warns against that. Certainly that would rule out marrying an unsaved person. It might even rule out marrying somebody that is a Christian or a church member or whatever, but doesn't really want to do God's will above everything else. So for that kind of person to marry someone who did want to do God's will above everything else would not be a good match. So those are the kinds of things I'd say about that.
And if you knew that God would allow you to live 20 more years, what project or projects would you most likely tackle?
That, to me, is the hardest question of all. Maybe I won't answer it directly, I'm not sure, but I will tell you a little bit about what's going on in my mind. Since I retired from teaching at the college for 47 years, that was my life's work. I felt like it's what God led me to, called me to, and that I was doing His will in doing that. When I retired, one of the things I kept thinking to myself is, now, you know, how much longer am I going to live, and what am I going to do? What am I going to spend my time doing? There were lots of things I wanted to do, so I didn't have any trouble thinking I wouldn't have anything to do. I wanted to do a lot of research and writing, and I have done so. One of the things, though, that I found myself saying to the Lord was, Lord, I'd like to have the same kind of sense of calling for what I do from now on that I had when I felt like I should go to the Bible college and be a teacher and so on. I think He's given me that in the matter of doing research and writing. It's a very satisfying kind of thing. I feel like that some of the things that I've produced may have been of help to some people here and there. I hope so, anyway. Some people tell me so. So probably if I should live 20 more years, and I don't think that's likely because that would make me 102, and I'm not expecting to get to 102. I'm not even expecting to get to 92. I would probably simply look at it in these terms. Okay, Lord, what's the next writing project You would like for me to undertake? And lead me in that. Give me a sense of confidence or a strong sense that this is what I ought to do. That's sort of the way I go about determining God's will, by the way, is asking Him to give me a strong feeling. This is the thing that I should do. The Lord works in many ways to guide us. His providence, circumstances that he brings about, that sort of thing. One of them, leading us by the principles of his word, is the main thing. To me, it's, as I say, getting a conviction that this is the way to go. Sometimes when I'm praying to the Lord, I say, Lord, help me to have, to hear that still small voice over my shoulder saying, this is the way, walk in it. Help me to be able to hear that, to sense the way you want me to go. And so I think within the rest of my life that's left, it would be probably some other writing project. There's a project now that I'm considering. I haven't fully committed myself to it yet, but I'm getting a little bit more strongly inclined in that direction, I guess, from a week or two to another, 1 month to another, something like that, to write. A defense of the idea of the freedom of the will against Martin Luther and John Calvin and Jonathan Edwards, men. Each of them wrote a book against free will. And so I've been thinking about writing along that line. And I've just finished reading Luther's book on the subject. And I'm in the middle of Calvin's book on the subject. And I've read Edwards' book once before, but I'll have to do it, go over it again. And making some notes as I go along, and I probably will do that.
Well, that's all that I really have.
Okay. So. Well, those are good questions, Jared.